Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Brian Lehrer and WNYC. Don't forget, Digesting Politics is back. It's our weekly podcast where Andrea Bernstein, Bob Headley, and I discuss politics over lunch. Digesting Politics is a web-only feature not heard on the radio. You can sign up for free at WNYC.org. Click on Brian Lehrer Show. Now, in the last few weeks, as you well know, our country has been talking a lot about race because of the Henry Louis Gates incident, which thrust the subtle prejudice of racial profiling and misplaced expectations back into the limelight. Today, maybe we can posit that one of the most insidious and persistent forms of profiling actually exists in the world of professional football. It's the notion that a black person cannot be a quarterback. Maybe that they lack the composure or the smarts or the work ethic to succeed at the most demanding position on the field. Well, my next guest helped to chip away at that stereotype, if not shatter it entirely. Warren Moon played in the NFL from 1984 to 2001, most notably with the Houston Oilers and then with the Minnesota Vikings. And before that, he was a star in the Canadian Football League. And if you combine his statistics from both leagues, no quarterback comes close to matching his accomplishments. And of course, Moon is black, the only black quarterback in the Pro Football Hall of Fame, as a matter of fact. He helped shift the expectation that someone who looks like Warren Moon could be a quarterback. But, of course, we as a society are still grappling with the expectation that someone who looks like Henry Louis Gates could teach at Harvard and live in a house like that. Warren Moon's new book is called Never Give Up Your Dream. And, Warren, welcome to WNYC. So nice to have you.
Oh, thanks for having me this morning. How you doing?
Good. You graduated from college in 1979, so that's exactly 30 years ago. What's your take on right now? Are we past the black quarterback stereotype? Is it a thing of the past?
Yeah, I think so around the NFL. I think there's a lot more open-minded thinking amongst general managers, definitely coaches, and now up into the ownership that an African-American quarterback can lead a football team, can be the face of a franchise, and can do the things that it takes to be a successful quarterback for an NFL football team. So you see many more African-American quarterbacks getting the opportunities to do that, and I think a lot of that has to do with guys that blazed the trail before myself, like Marlon Briscoe and James Harris and guys like that, and then the way Doug Williams performed at the Washington Redskins and winning a Super Bowl, and then the way my career and also Randall Cunningham's went, it kind of opened the door for all these other African-American quarterbacks now getting more opportunities.
And I think I misspoke earlier before you came on when I said you were the first black quarterback in the NFL. You just mentioned some of your predecessors, so I guess that is not accurate. You are the first in the Hall of Fame.
Yes.
You went undrafted out of college and spent a long time having success in the Canadian Football League before any NFL team signed you up. Did you feel that that was overtly or subtly because of your race?
Yeah, I think some of it had to do with it, no question about it. You know, it was more that same stereotype that it wasn't that it was racism in the NFL, because there was obviously many black players in many different positions, but because of the quarterback position, that stereotype just kind of stood there amongst coaches and owners and general managers that the black quarterback was not something that they wanted. So they wanted to move my position. They wanted to change me to a defensive back or a wide receiver in order to take advantage of my athletic ability, not thinking that I could do the other things that it took to be a quarterback. So that, it was kind of hurting and unsettling for me, but I'm a very, very, I guess, stubborn guy, a very confident guy in my abilities, and I just felt like I wanted to be a quarterback. My dream was to play in the National Football League, and I wasn't going to let anybody tell me that I couldn't.
And in your Hall of Fame induction speech, talking about being the first black quarterback, you said, it's a subject that I'm very uncomfortable about sometimes, only because I've always wanted to be judged as just a quarterback. So do you still feel that way, or have you become more comfortable talking about race?
I'm much more comfortable talking about it, but at the time when I was playing, I didn't want to bring a lot of attention to it. I wanted to let my play and all the things that people had questions about answer those questions. So I stayed away from the race subject as much as I possibly could, unless I was directly asked about it. And now that I'm done with the game and things are so much better, it's freer for me to talk about, because it was something that I went through. A lot of those feelings I buried inside of me, and now I'm willing to talk about them and kind of express myself.
Did you play angry because of this?
I really played with that chip, like I was talking about. And I think that chip on my shoulder, I kind of used it as motivation to help me. It helped motivate me. It kept me working out. I was a fanatic workout guy in the off season. Very, very hard on myself as far as my critical play. I didn't want anybody to outwork me, and I was never really satisfied with my performances. So I think it was something that I used as a positive, as opposed to dwelling on it and becoming a negative.
Former NFL quarterback Warren Moon, my guest on WNYC, his new book called Never Give Up Your Dream. We have time for a couple of phone calls. Any Warren Moon fans out there? 212-433-WNYC. And it doesn't have to be about race. You can ask him anything about football. 212-433-9692 to talk to Warren Moon this morning. And I guess that question of race and the guys at the top of the NFL pecking order has kind of migrated from quarterback to coach. Because in college football, there are 117 Division I teams. We looked this up, and only 4 black head coaches, and you write about this. How big of a persistent problem do you think this is if the problem with stereotyping quarterbacks has pretty much disappeared?
Well, it's a huge problem because if you look statistically around the NFL, about 68 to 70% of the players on a NFL roster are black, so you would think that there would be more black head coaches. And in the NFL, it's getting better. I think there's 5 or 6 right now, but in college football, yeah, that number is way, way off, and it needs to really increase and improve. And hopefully the NCAA will do some things to make sure that does improve and that more African-American coaches get an opportunity to at least interview for jobs. You at least want to be able to be put in front of a athletic director or a school president and kind of see what your personality is all about and let them see, you know, who you are and what you're made of. And maybe that will open some more doors for you to get some other opportunities to get a job as a NCAA coach.
Jane in Brooklyn, you're on WNYC with Warren Moon. Hi, Jane.
Hi, how are you?
Good. Football fan?
Not really, but I do listen to a lot of sports radio with my husband in the car,
and
he's a big football fan. And I notice time and again when they're talking about black quarterbacks, they always tend to compare them, the sportscasters, to other black quarterbacks as opposed to comparing their skills just in general to other players in the league. And I notice this with other sports as well, like in basketball where there seem to be more black players and fewer white players. They tend to compare white players to other white players as if, and it's sort of, I feel like it's very subconscious. It's as if a black person and a white person simply can't be compared in terms of their skills on a sports field, which seems like it should be the place where racism doesn't exist at all.
Actually, Warren, you're a broadcaster now, aren't you? Don't you do the games for the Seahawks?
Yeah, I do the games for the Seahawks and also Westwood One. I do a Monday night games for Westwood One for the NFL.
So have you noticed that in some of your colleagues, as Jane describes it?
Yeah, you do notice that sometimes, and I think some of that has to do with different styles, that African Americans, especially quarterbacks, tend to be a little bit more athletic, a little bit more versatile as far as being able to run around and move and do things. So I think people tend to compare styles to each other, and sometimes those styles tend to be race-related. So that's something I try not to do. I try to put, say, a Donovan McNabb in the same category as a Tom Brady or a Peyton Manning.
Mm-hmm.
Even though their styles aren't the exact same, the results are the same, and that's really what you're looking at.
And, Jane, it's obvious who controls the radio in your car, so...
I don't drive, so my husband gets to choose what we listen to.
But that was a very, very good question, no question about it.
Russell in Massapequa, you're on WNYC. Hello, Russell.
Hi, Brian, how are you?
Okay.
Great show.
Thank
all the time. Hey, Warren.
Yes, sir.
Great NFL career.
Thank you very much.
And I grew up as a Jet fan from Shea Stadium to the Meadowlands, and maybe you'll recall the game. It was like 1988 or 89. The Oilers with the Jets at the Meadowlands. You guys were down by 21 points in the first half.
Right.
And you came back and won that game.
You remember that game?
I remember that.
That was probably one of the best games I ever saw you play, and I saw you play quite often.
That was a game where a reporter asked me after that game, when did you stop being a black quarterback?
Oh, my
oh, really?
God.
Yeah.
That was one of the best comebacks by any team. And I'll tell you, the story was, there were two in the first or second
half.
Okay,
you know what? I'm sorry to do it, but we don't have time to go through the whole thing. But I'll just agree with you, Russell, that Jets fans, like you and me, have any number of historic loss stories that we could tell.
Yeah, well
I've been involved in some good comebacks and some big losses, too, so I know exactly where the Jet fan is talking about right there.
And the comeback against the Buffalo Bills,
exactly.
Right? That question that you just referred to, when did you stop being a black quarterback? Did you like that question or not like that question?
I kind of chuckled at it because I looked at my skin and I said, well, as far as I'm concerned, I still am. But I knew exactly what he was talking about. He just didn't phrase it very well. He was basically saying, when did I stop being referred to just in being a black quarterback? Because a lot of times they always would put black quarterback before, you know, they talk about you as a quarterback, where I finally got to the point where they were just saying I was a quarterback, which was great. And I knew what he was saying, but I kind of got a chuckle out of it just because of the way it came out.
You know, we're here in New York, and today the big football news is that Eli Manning has agreed to a 6-year, $97 million contract extension. That's an average salary of roughly $15.3 million. When you first signed in the NFL, you earned a little under $2 million, which honestly, to most of our listeners, still sounds like an over-the-top
money. Yes.
But what do you make of the exploding size? You know, the debate on Sports Talk here today is Eli Manning worth the money?
Well, you know, any athlete is worth anything that he can get because, especially in pro football, nothing is really guaranteed to you. You could end your career, you know, the next time you go out there. The great thing about his contract, part of that, the $97 million is guaranteed, about $35 million of it. So he'll at least see that much of it regardless of what happens to him. But I think it's great. I think that's something we went on strike for in 1987. I was a union rep and part of the executive council, and that was one of the things we went on strike for, was free agency in football. And what it did was it really made the salaries open up. Players now had a lot more leverage to bargain with different teams and move around. And you're seeing the results of that today. So I'm happy for the guys to be able to get what they get, as long as they understand and remember the guys who fought for what they are getting today.
The owners are going to set the ticket prices at whatever they can bring in, so it's just about getting a share of whatever that that total pool is, right? I always took the union side in that one.
Yeah, you're right. I think the union is somewhere between 60 and 63% of the gross, and there's a huge collective bargaining agreement being negotiated right now, and hopefully they get that done, and so they will have labor peace and there won't be a strike in football, because that's one of the things that's made the sport so popular right now, is that they have had labor peace for so long.
And I think the contracts, if they went down, they would not make the ticket prices go down. Robert Hodge in Garden City. Professor Robert Hodge, you're on WNYC. Hello.
Yes, sir. Hello, Warren. Hello, Brian.
How are you?
Excellent. Do you think that race had anything to do whatsoever with Plaxico Burress's indictment on Monday, or was it just his total lack of firearms laws in the state of New York?
Go ahead.
Yeah, I think the fire laws had a whole lot to do with it, especially with Mayor Bloomberg being the one that was behind the that new law being put in place. I'm sure he doesn't want to see any preferential treatment go to any a celebrity type of person, especially with a law that he worked so hard to put in place. So it's unfortunate that a guy like Plaxico Burress, who isn't a bad guy, probably had that weapon because he wanted protection, but just didn't have the right license to carry it, and he ends up shooting himself and might spend 3 years in prison. It's a very tragic situation, but you know, we kind of go by the laws of our country.
And since you've retired, you've spent a lot of time working in the community with various charities and so on, but we continue to see the problems that current athletes and ex-athletes face in the so-called real world. Why is it so hard to transition?
You know, it's hard. Sometimes they say you can take the kid out of the ghetto, but you can't take the ghetto out of the kid, or whatever it might be. You're kind of a product of your environment, and sometimes it's hard to leave that environment. Even though you might move away from where you grew up, you still have the same friends that you had in the same neighborhood, and you still tend to hang out at some of the same places. And some of those places and some of those associations that you have might be part of the negatives that follow you around, because here you are at a certain status in your life as far as being a professional athlete or whatever it might be, and then you're hanging around with guys who probably aren't on the same page or on the same plane as you, and sometimes you're guilty by association because some of those guys are doing some things that you wouldn't necessarily do, but because you're around around and you're the big name, you're going to be the guy that's being blamed or get the most publicity out of it. So you really have to worry about and understand who you're hanging out with and who you associate with these days, because it can get you in a lot of trouble.
Mike in Bayhead, you're on WNYC with Warren Moon. We got 15 seconds for you.
Yeah, hi, Brian, and hi, Warren. Nice to talk to you.
You too.
I think I was at that same Jets game that the previous caller talked about, and I came away thinking that I've never seen a tighter spiral, and I'd never seen anybody throw bullets the way you did.
Describe it. What makes a good – how do you throw the ball so that it spirals like a football is supposed to go?
You know, it just takes a lot of practice, and people have tried to ask me how to throw the football, and it's really hard to tell every person how, because everybody's grip is a little bit different, everybody's hand size is a little bit different. But for me, it's my forefinger, and believe it or not, my fingernail on that particular finger. If that fingernail is at the right length, and I've actually filed that fingernail down during games to get it to the right length, then that ball is really going to spin for me. So it's a little secret there that I have, but it's hard for me to tell somebody else. If you do this, you'll be able to do that.
More than you ever wanted to know about Warren Moon's fingernails, the former NFL star, only black quarterback in the NFL Hall of Fame, new book called Never Give Up Your Dream. You can hear him on Westwood One and during Seattle Seahawks games. Thank you so much. This has been great. Thanks for spending the time with us.
Hey, thanks for having me on. Really appreciate it.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC.